Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Deadhead Cannabis Show. This is Jim Marty reporting in from a beautiful fall day here in Colorado. I have my partner here, Rob Hunt. Rob, how you doing?
I'm great, Jim. Just enjoying another fun day of cannabis and all things cannabis business.
Very good. What do we have to talk about today? There's a lot of interesting things going on. We have election, off-year elections coming up. We have a Grateful Dead memorabilia for sale on the internet. October's a great month in Grateful Dead history, so we got a lot of things we can talk about today.
We sure do. So yeah, kicking it off, let's talk about the Sotheby's auction. I don't think that's one that, you know, too many people are aware of, but if you're a collector of Grateful Dead memorabilia, definitely pull up the Sotheby's auction website and then just type in Grateful Dead. But there are hundreds of items right now that are up for sale. Some that are super, super cool. Other ones that, you know, probably won't appeal to a mass audience. But, you know, a lot of it is amplifiers and speakers and, you know, certain keyboards. Like, it's a lot of the keyboards the Grateful Dead keyboard players used over the years, all available right now for sale. So if you want to pick up something that's just, you know, super unique and something that, you know, came out of the wall of sound, now's a great time to do it because these things don't come around all that often.
Yeah, I took a quick look at it, and it looks like a lot of the speakers and amps and things that that Bear put together for the Grateful Dead.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot of that. I mean, some of those are, you know, have the insides kind of stripped out of them. Other ones are still, you know, actively and able to be used. But it's you know, the sheer volume of actually what's been put in there. This is, you know, a couple truckloads worth of stuff that has now gone to auction. So the auction is still live and active, and anyone out there has got the opportunity to bid on it. And a lot of things are pretty much right at the reserve price right now, haven't really gotten much higher. So it's not like it's, you know, one of Doug Irwin's, you know, Garcia guitars that's being auctioned off. It's a lot of stuff that's, you know, kind of not quite as well known, but it certainly allows, you know, anyone that's a real fan to have a real piece of Grateful Dead memorabilia as part of their collection.
Yeah, really interesting stuff. I just visited there for a few minutes. Well, that's a good way to start things off. And then it getting into fall here and coming up on the off-year elections, some political things going on. And in my home state of Colorado, under the category of politics can make strange bedfellows, we have an initiative that would raise adult use taxes at the cash register. The opponents are saying by as much as 30%. And then the supporters, or a lot of social equity friends of mine, are backing it. So here we have two groups that are normally together are on opposite ends on this. So I've had phone calls from both, you know, hey, we're not going to support this. We want to defeat this. Taxes are high enough for adult use at the cash register as they are. To some of my friends from the black social equity community, Jim, you got to get your industry on board with this. It's going to support all these great programs. But if you, I actually got my ballot. What's interesting, and this is how we do things here in Colorado, we passed a Voters Bill of Rights a number of years ago. So the state of Colorado, the governor, the legislature cannot raise taxes without a voter initiative. So they get around that by calling a lot of things they want to do user fees. But this particular one is a ballot initiative that we'll vote on that first Tuesday in November. And we'll see which way it goes. But yeah, they plan to raise $1.3 million a year. So they don't really say what percentage it'll be. They'll back into the percentage, saying we're now authorized to raise this much money from adult use retail sales, and therefore the rate needs to be this. So if it passes, that's how it'll be put together. But a lot of concerns from the industry that it's just, we're already over 20%. So this will put it over 25% most likely. And a lot of concerns that would drive cannabis users back to the illicit market. Rob, any comments?
Yeah, I mean, just so kind of along the same lines of a lot of what we talked about previously, Jim, which is that, you know, I keep trying to impress upon state legislators or on, you know, municipal legislators that taxing cannabis, while it sounds great and it looks like it's a panacea to, you know, line your coffers with newfound cash, it doesn't work as long as the illicit market is still out there and a viable option. And if they tax it to a point where the consumer now has a better choice in the illicit market, there's no motivation for people to access the legal market. You know, if I could go out and buy the same microbrews or the same quality of wine that I can get at the liquor store for a fraction of the cost, and I'm not, you know, losing any sort of degradation in quality, I wouldn't be going to liquor stores these days. The only reason I go to a liquor store or the supermarket is A, convenience, B, selection, but most importantly, C, price. And so, you know, if you taxed one so much higher when the illicit market's still around, it doesn't make a great deal of sense, because I would much rather, if I were the state or the or a municipality, I'd rather have 100% of a pie with a smaller amount, you know, attributed to it, than only gaining like 30% of the pie, where, you know, you're reaching into the pockets of the guys that are actually trying to do things properly. And so I don't know how we can get it across to the state legislators that this is not going to work out the way you think it is. If you raise the tax by an additional 10%, but it causes, you know, 20% less people to access the market, you're in trouble. And, you know, I looked at the initiative today, and I also looked at the fact that Colorado is reporting for the first time ever that it may have a down year. It may have less sales of cannabis in 2021 than it had in 2020. And so if you look at the $2.1 billion that was put up last year in Colorado, that's a big number. And still tracking for right around that. But this will be the first year, even if it's flat, it'll be the first year that's been flat. And so, you know, you have to ask yourself, does this mean that we've completely captured every person in the addressable market to access the legal industry? And I think being in Colorado, you can clearly say the answer to that is no. I mean, I know the answer to that is no.
Yes. Many of our clients and friends in the industry are reporting flat or down sales. So they're not having the best year like they did last year. You know, they were really a beneficiary of COVID last year, with people on unemployment or getting their stimulus money and working from home, where they could consume more cannabis than they might normally do. So that novelty is kind of worn off, and we are definitely seeing flat sales in 2021. The other thing that's really hurting the industry in Colorado right now is, I think they have it in California too, we call it Croptober. And that's when a lot of the outdoor crop comes into the retail operations and really hurts prices. So pounds are going for $800 to $1,200 right now at wholesale. That's what the cultivators are selling their product to the retailers for. A lot of times their costs are way more than $800 a pound. That's what I work on a lot with them, is trying to get their cost to grow a pound down. And calling some of my good clients, hey, how come you're getting behind here on paying? You always paid my bill on time. I said, oh man, we're lucky to get $800 for our pounds right now. We're really hurting.
Well, aren't you lucky? Colorado is seeing $800 pounds, because California right now is seeing $400 and $500 pounds.
Wow.
So you want to talk about, you know, the flood hitting. You know, it's been that way. We've seen the biggest price drop that California's ever seen over the last 3 or 4 months. And that was before harvest really came down, the outdoor harvest. You know, this is all just light depth harvests that are coming down. So we expect to see it get significantly worse in the next month or two. And I have the feeling this will be one of the first years where, you know, there's going to be cannabis that doesn't, you know, ever get sold, or that lasts all the way until, you know, January or February, or people are just taking their entire harvest and blasting it and winterizing their crude, hoping that they can find a home for it later on. But right now it's relatively dire in California. And, you know, I looked at other markets where people are still selling $4,000 wholesale pounds, and just thinking, you guys have no idea how lucky you have it by comparison to the states that are real producer states with a real outdoor market.
Oh, that's exactly right. I work in some of those states, have clients in some of those states with the $4,000, $4,500 pounds. It's just, you know, we build into their business plans sharp declines over the next 5 years. So we don't think that those prices will stay up there at $4,500 a pound as more and more cultivators come online. So in California, when you talk about $400 pounds, is that outdoor?
It's outdoor and it's depths. You know, some of the mids that are coming out of the depth facilities, you know, hoop houses, those are all, you know, going for $400 or $500 a pound right now. Like anyone that was selling pounds for like $1,100 at this time, you know, 4 months ago, I should say, they're seeing almost a 40%, 40, 50% reduction in value. And there's no sign of it abating.
Yeah, it is a commodity. It's a farm commodity. You and I and our partner Larry have predicted this for years, as more and more cultivation licenses are issued nationwide. And it just gets ridiculously expensive. You know, when you're talking $60 for an eighth, $70 out the door when you add on the taxes, you know, that's quite a expense on your monthly bill.
Yeah, that's top shelf pricing. And we haven't seen so much degradation on top shelf out here in California. This is really on sort of the mids. And the mids, you know, are going for so much less. The top shelf has certainly taken a hit in the wholesale price, you know, going down from about $2,100 a pound to call it $1,600 a pound. But it's still, you know, it's still relatively holding price for nice indoor. It's just the outdoor and the sort of non-high-tech greenhouse that we're seeing the major degradation. And what I'll tell you is, while we've predicted the commoditization and price compression of cannabis in general, what I'll tell you is that ultimately, you know, California, I think, is still in a great position, because with federal legalization, you will see California cannabis flood the markets that are selling pounds at 4,000, and all of a sudden, every one of those producers is in big, big trouble when they've got to compete with, you know, California cannabis that's now moving into their market, where if you were getting 4,000 before and someone's willing to sell that same cannabis for 1,500, 2,000, I just don't see how the infrastructure in all these other states have been built up continues, you know, post-legalization. Like, there's no reason ever for Illinois to produce, you know, cannabis to be sold in Illinois or New York or any of those states. It just makes so much more sense to import everything from California.
It does, and not to mention Oregon is the tip of the Emerald Triangle as well. But I wonder, even if we have federal legalization, will there be interstate commerce, or will it stay with each state being a silo?
Eventually, it'll be interstate commerce. I don't think initially. I mean, I think we've talked about the Commerce Clause issues and the Dormant Commerce Clause issues that go along with this. So I wouldn't expect to see it right away, but I'd certainly see, you know, interstate compacts developing where California, Oregon, and Washington have, you know, free flow of cannabis across their borders. It's only the states that are trying to protect their industry, the oligopoly-style states like New York, that's going to try to keep people out for a period of time. But ultimately, I don't see how they get through that, and I don't think there's an attorney out there that's really looked at the issue closely and has said that ultimately it'll fail and you'd have to allow, you know, cannabis to come through. Now, I think the states will be able to have some sort of self-determination or self-rule the way they do with liquor. Like, you know, you can determine, you know, who it is that actually sells liquor in your state, but can they prevent the free flow of goods coming across into the state? It's going to be real tough for them to do over the long term. So I'm still a real better on, you know, if you're going to invest in a place to build infrastructure for cultivation, it wouldn't be in the northern states. It would absolutely be in somewhere in Southern California, somewhere in the Inland Empire, or somewhere in the Central Valley, as it just has by far the best growing climate. I wouldn't even go in the northern, into the Emerald Triangle. I wouldn't go into Oregon or any of those spots, because their quality of light and their quality of sun is just not nearly what it is in SoCal.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Well, that got us off on a bit of a talk about the overall industry. We started by talking about an initiative on the Colorado ballot. So we'll report back in a couple of weeks and let you know how that ballot initiative turned out and what the implications of it either winning or losing are. Well, what else is going on, Rob?
Well, there's definitely some big mergers and acquisitions in the space right now. I don't know if you saw it was announced yesterday or today that PharmaCann is buying LiveWell, which is, in terms of a private transaction, it's by far the single biggest private transaction I've ever seen. Neither company is required to report, you know, what the price tag is. I don't think we'll ever know. But if I were to guess, John Lord at LiveWell is about to be a very, very wealthy man. I mean, he's already a very wealthy man, but I think he's about to sail off into the sunset, not needing to ever do anything else again in his life if this is really truly an acquisition by PharmaCann of LiveWell. So that's a huge one. And on the other side, we had a huge breakup between Ceres and Parallel, where Bo Wrigley's company called off the $1.9 billion merger with Scooter Braun of Justin Bieber fame, his company. So, you know, we're seeing, as exactly as expected, 2021 still continues to be the year of the M&A. It still continues to have just sort of like volcanic, titanic deals that are either happening or breaking up, whether it's, you know, lawsuits between, you know, Adam Bierman and the guys at Coastal, or whether it's breakups between Ceres and Parallel, or whether it's acquisitions of PharmaCann and LiveWell. We are watching just major, major activity happen in mergers and acquisitions.
Yes, I got that notification from one of my good friends over at LiveWell yesterday. I've worked with them for many years. I still do occasional things for them. They've moved on to some large national accounting firms for their work. But good people over there, and I do wish the Lords, father and son, the best. They've worked very hard. They run a great business. They've expanded from Colorado, and they're now in Michigan as well. So I don't know that much about PharmaCann.
Illinois-based, big company, definitely on track to go public here in the near term. Surprised they haven't already. But, you know, the last raise they did, I think, was at a valuation of north of $400 million, and that was over a year ago. I've got to think their valuation is significantly higher based on revenue production right now. But they're the last Illinois company, I think, that's still private. You know, I think Verano was the only other one before that. But I'm pretty sure PharmaCann has a New York license as well. you know, they've got a good footprint. And, you know, if I look at Colorado and I think who the three or four behemoths are in Colorado, you know, Live Well and Native Roots, and, you know, probably like the Buddy Boys slash the whole John Fritzell empire of stores, you know, is probably the three largest right now. Green Solutions was the other one, and they got taken out by Columbia Care. So, you know, there aren't many real independents that are left in Colorado. A lot of the bigger ones have already been, you know, scooped up, or they're in the process of consolidating right now. And, you know, as you know, Colorado for a long time wasn't able to be acquired by outside groups because of the residency requirements that existed. So while Colorado had this massive first advantage in the market in general 7, 8, 9 years ago, they couldn't act on it. You know, they should have been the first companies to go public. The first company, you know, you should have seen like the clinic go public, and you should have seen, you know, Native Roots go public. And those guys would have been the acquirers of all their competition. It didn't happen that way because Colorado had kind of a draconian law about, you know, being able to accept investment from anyone outside of the state. And that really slowed down the growth of the Colorado industry to be the dominant players, you know, coming out of the 1.0 phase of legal cannabis. And it's too bad. You know, now they're being acquired instead of being the acquirees.
Yes, yeah, that change happened, I think, 2016, 2017. So, yeah, we're now feeling the effects of being able to have out-of-state ownership of our Colorado cannabis companies. But, yeah, most of the people I work in, you know, 10, 12 years, Colorado, since we started really taking off in 2009 and then getting adult use in 2014, certainly most people who have been in the business that long are looking for an exit of some sort.
Yeah, and I think that's nice that some of these guys will have one, but I think it would have been a lot nicer if a lot of those guys had been the ones that had taken their companies public first, and, you know, now had the $5 billion market caps the way a lot of their Illinois slash, you know, other state counterparts do. You know, with Colorado really paving the way for the rest of the country, it would have been nice if some of my close friends, you know, were the entrepreneurs that really, really made it. Now, some of them have, you know, some of them are you know, north of $100 million guys now, but there should have been a lot more of them based on the way the industry developed.
Well, think we should talk about some Grateful Dead stuff, or is more catch up on the industry here?
I'm always happy to talk about Grateful Dead stuff, Jim. I mean, we could all sorts of good stuff. Obviously, Dead and Company tour is still happening right now. I think they're playing through the South as we speak, and I think they're headed your way, right? They Red Rocks bound here pretty soon.
Yeah, next week, two Red Rocks shows and two shows at Fiddler's Green. So we're getting four shows all together. Just hope it doesn't snow. We got a little dusting of snow last night. Colorado in October, it can be summer or it can be winter.
And I know our good buddy Larry Mishkin is not with us today because he's still recovering from his three-night run at the Portchester Capitol Theater. I didn't get an update on the third night, but the first two nights I got some great updates and the set list looked great. And Larry's been raving that, you know, they're as good as he ever thought they'd be with as the quintet, and that Warren is just, you know, absolutely crushing it. But I don't know if you got in the same text message as I did when he was out there, but they sure look like fun shows.
Yes, and Phil's in great form at 81 years old. Very, very thin, but look, he looks strong and healthy, and he's dancing about the stage. And we just saw him in September here in Colorado. I think the Colorado run was a warm-up for the Capitol shows in New York. So I'm glad to hear he's having fun with that, and I'll report back on the Colorado shows. And hopefully, like I said, we'll have good weather for that next week. But yeah. Dead and Company at Red Rocks. What a treat. I saw Bob there earlier this summer.
I wonder how many people in the cannabis industry are skipping it to go down to Vegas instead. You know, both things are happening this week. So do you go to MJ Business or do you see Dead and Co? It's, you know, kind of a toss-up.
Yes. And again, I don't know which one I'll attend first or last, but I'll try to dip my toe in the water at least a little bit in Vegas and then catch a show in Colorado. So I'll be reporting back. But yeah, MJ BizCon next week, first big cannabis convention since COVID, and we'll see how that goes. Vegas seems very crowded. I called ahead to make some dinner reservations and got turned down by some of my favorite restaurants in Las Vegas. Of course, I was trying to make a reservation for 10 people, but I said 2 weeks ahead and I can't get a reservation. So yeah, I think MJ BizCon in Vegas will be very interesting. As I said, first large convention since cannabis. I'm not sure if they'll have mask requirements or not, but I'll report back and let you know how that goes.
They do. I was actually in Vegas last weekend, and every casino requires you have a mask on the casino floor and in all the hotels. You can't walk anywhere inside in Vegas without a mask on right now. So I'd expect that that'll be the same through MJ BizCon this week.
Okay. Well, I'll make sure I'm prepared. So, but October, big month in the Grateful Dead's world. I did some research for this show the other night, came up with a great show on 10/17/74. You know, wonderful set list. We're going to listen to a little bit in just a few minutes of a Casey Jones from that show that made it onto the double live album that's often referred to as Steal Your Face, which is the iconic skull and lightning bolt on a plain white album cover. Yeah, listen to that show. Some great tunes on it. There's a Feel Like a Stranger. There's a nice Weather Report suite. Very, very strong set list. That don't happen to have it right in front of me. Do you, Rob?
I do. It's actually, I know the show pretty well. It's a 14-song first set with an 11-song second set with a couple things that make it great. And I don't think there is a stranger on that on the show. So it's a Promised Land half-step, black-throated, Friend of the Devil, Jack Straw, Loser, El Paso, into one of the best China Riders of the early 70s, just a stellar China Rider. Me and My Uncle Must Bend the Roses, with then a full Weather Report to close it out with the Let It Grow. And then the second set was fantastic. It's one of the last times that Scarlet got played before it got paired with Fire. So it opened the second set with the Scarlet Big River. And sort of the highlight of the night was the Ramble On, then a Mexicali, and a He's Gone. And then they kicked into something that, you know, most people refer to as one of the great ones, which is the Other One into a Spanish jam, into a Mind Left Body jam, back into the Other One jam, and into the Other One. That was like a 24-minute Other One sandwich, I guess, you know, with a Spanish jam and a Mind Left Body, or Heaven Help jam, depending on what you want to call it, in the middle. And then closing out with the Stella Blue Sugar Mags. And then they double encored, and they double encored with the Casey Jones U.S. Blues. So this was meant to be the first, like, sort of closing of the Winterland in 74, before the actual, like, time when the Winterland itself closed. But it was like the Grateful Dead's farewell to the Winterland, when they didn't think they were going to play it anymore because they'd outgrown the room. And so they recorded a lot of it. The Casey Jones, as you said, goes on Steal Your Face, and that China Rider actually ended up in the Grateful Dead movie.
Yeah, I just watched the Grateful Dead movie. Boy, that's a classic. I really enjoyed that. It had the old video VHS tape, and that shows some great, great scenes of Winterland in that. It also was near the end of the first kind of leg of the Grateful Dead, because in 1975, they headed into the hiatus, took some time off, and as a result, we got out of that hiatus came Blues for All, if I have all my timelines correct.
Yeah, I think that's right. Well, Blues for All came after the Egypt tour, the Egypt shows, which I think were 78. But you definitely got a fair amount of like good stuff coming back, and they came back super strong in 75 after they took the break. I can't remember what the first show back was, but it was a beast that they ended up putting out as one of the first Dick's Picks, or one of the first live Dead albums in the the non-traditional album phase of the band in like the early 90s. So it was a terrific period of creativity that I think the hiatus really was the catalyst of.
Yes, for sure. So, well, let's listen to a little bit of that Casey Jones. Thunder.
It is. It's straight enthusiasm out of that Casey Jones. And the show I was thinking of before is when they came out with the Great American Music Hall show. So, you know, as you said, they came out with so much energy at the end of 74 and then brought it back in when they came off hiatus in 75. So I always think whenever they played the Winterland as kind of a finale, Winterland just had so much energy. Yes. In it.
Yeah, and that... I am correct when I say that is the backdrop for the Grateful Dead movie.
Yeah, it is. It is.
So all the books that you read about Winterland and the wooden floor and, you know, the hot dog stands, all that's very well put together in the Grateful Dead movie.
Yeah, and by the way, Jim, you're spot on. Blues for All is 1975. I was just checking on that, and I thought for some reason it happened post-Egypt, but you're absolutely right.
Yes, I thought so. Haven't been old enough to buy the record.
Yeah, no, you're right. So I think that was the catalyst for them wanting to go to Egypt, perhaps, and I just had that in reverse.
Well, and it is a bit of a sidetrack, but Egypt came about through a cultural exchange that the Carter administration did as part of the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. And so that's another little piece of history of how the Grateful Dead actually got to Egypt.
Wasn't aware of that, but I know that it was certainly one of those trips that I think everyone, if they, you know, anyone that was on that trip has looked back and said that was one of the highlights of their life as far as travel, of just being such a unique time to be able to play in front of the pyramids of Giza.
And the videos from Egypt are just amazing, seeing the Sherpas dancing to the Grateful Dead, just amazing video footage.
Yeah, totally. And yeah, it's amazing that in 75, you know, coming out of this, there's only four shows played in 75 at all, which were one Kezar, one Winterland, one Great American Music Hall, and one in Lindley Meadows in Golden Gate Park. So the Dead that year never even left California, and they sort of staggered four shows across the year. So this really was, you know, towards the end of the as you said, 1.0 of Grateful Dead before they took their first real hiatus.
Right. And when did they come back and start touring regularly again after the hiatus?
I believe in early 76. I mean, 76 was a relatively relatively jam-packed year of shows. But I think 75 was more of just let's take a break, let's reconvene and decide what we want to do. But it was plenty of shows in 76.
All right. So, without our third leg, Larry Mishkin, I think we'll cut the show a little bit short today, unless you have other things you want to bring up.
No, I think we've covered a fair amount. And so, for all those out there that don't get a chance to listen to a period of, 74, I know we had David Gans on a couple weeks ago who said 73 was his favorite year. And, for a lot of reasons that he mentioned, 74 I find to be exceptional. So, for those of you that aren't necessarily, sort of the Primal Dead, Fillmore style people, and you're not, the 80s, Godshaw period, 74 is kind of a great way to bridge the gap before it really turned into like the juggernaut we knew in 77, 78. So go back and take a listen to the show. It's got, as I said, the other one, Spanish Jam, Mind Left Body, other one's amazing, and the China Riders is absolutely spectacular. So great way to spend your afternoon, listen to some Grateful Dead, and smoke some more cannabis.
All right, I think we have another outtake from that show to sign us off.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Hey everyone, it's Ryan from the Cannabis Connoisseur podcast. If you're looking for ways to utilize cannabis to keep you healthy, strong, and sharp, come join us every Wednesday where we dive into the best ways to use cannabis to optimize your life. Topics include cannabis and athletics, cannabis for productivity, cannabis for anxiety, cannabis for a healthy immune system, and so much more. If you're a curious connoisseur, this show is for you. So please head over to our page, and we're looking forward to seeing you this week. Bye.